You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Leader, and you are listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Stephanie Leader. She's the author of Love, Coffee, and Revolution, a novel. Stephanie, how are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Tony.
I'm happy you're here because we get to talk about your debut novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw the blurbs, and we have a mutual friend, Mark Haskell Smith, who blurbed the book.
Oh, the best. He's such a great writer.
Yeah. And he's in France right now doing his book tour because he's huge in France.
Yeah, he's having this huge, amazing European adventure. It's so cool.
Yeah, I know. I'm just like, oh, I wish I had enough money to be to tag along and be a roadie. But, you know, right now, the money got tight all of a sudden. So.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah. So this novel seems like, well, according to your bio, It seems like it's well researched because it's kind of lived. Is that the
case?
Yeah,
there are definitely elements. I lived in Costa Rica when I was a student, and I worked on a fair trade coffee campaign in California. So I didn't do what the main character did in Costa Rica, but I have worked on that kind of campaign and I have lived there. So while people ask, is it autobiographical? It's like, no, none of what happened, but is it autobiographical on that I experienced a lot of those things? Sure. And does the character sound a lot like me or a 20-year-old version of me? Yes, it does.
Yeah. And I also think though with fiction, what we're looking for in fiction and novel is the emotional truth, more than the play-by-play that we would get in a memoir or such. Which is why I prefer novels over memoirs every single day. So
interesting, because you feel like the emotional truth is stronger in a novel.
Yeah, because I feel moved. I don't feel moved when I read too many memoirs. I feel moved when I read a novel, especially when there is an authoritative voice of a person who's actually had boots on the ground. And that's what I tell my students all the time. I'm just like, you know, if you're gonna add Costa Rica as your setting, you better have boots on the ground in Costa Rica. You better
That's
know
right.
The energy of the city you're talking about. It comes through. Even if you might be able to get facts online, but it comes through if you've been there. And then there's an honesty to the narrative.
Oh, 100%. I'm working on a new novel right now that's set in DC Annapolis. And I've been there once 20 years ago. So when I finish this first draft, then I'm going to go there, you know, spend some time with friends. It's got like a Secret Service NSA government plot. So I need to go. I've talked to some people here, but I want to go there so that it has reality, because looking it up, it's not the same. You just can't write with the same passion, or certainly it's not as vivid if you don't know what you're trying to describe, or from a flat 2D image.
And I feel like there is emotions tied to locations. So we need to experience the emotions of being tied to a location. In DC, is that where you're going?
Yeah, the new one is in DC. But yeah, I mean, I set this in Costa Rica because living there was the most transformative time of my life. You know, like I went there as a student, I spoke Spanish, but it was really more theoretical. Like I could pass the test, you know, I could read it, I could write it, but I could speak it poorly. But understanding people speaking at you in real time quickly with slang, that's a whole other skill set that I really didn't have. And so having to really become fluent, and I wasn't there to study Spanish. I was there studying my regular college major, which was sociology. So I was your typical like type A student, like an A minus was failure. My dad used to joke with me. You know, my dad, Tony, has interviewed my dad, and he would be like,
I know your dad.
I think you, maybe you didn't. Didn't you know my dad, Ruben Leader? I think you may have.
I'm saying it's ringing a bell, but
okay. Sorry. Anyway,
Oh wait,
He
I
was the
think I
jury.
had him on my radio show.
Yeah, yeah,
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
yeah.
He wrote You Might Feel a Little Prick,
Right. Oh,
just
I
like
remember that.
a
Yeah.
dark medical comedy.
How is
And
that?
he's
How is
with
your
Drew
dad
Barrymore.
doing, and how does he feel that his daughter has a novel out?
Oh my God, he's great. He is so proud. It's just, he was proud when I went into TV, but I think now that I've published a novel, his like pride is just off the charts. He's so happy for me. He's really excited.
It's fascinating about the TV film versus novel thing, because even though I've dabbled a little bit in the film and such, when people find out I'm a novelist, all of a sudden that's the oddity, and that's like, oh wow, oh you're they almost kind of put you on a pedestal, and you're like, oh, then one, you don't know how hard it is to be a novelist. Two, you don't know what a bad idea it is at the same time. It's like,
Yeah,
it's
I
like,
know.
it's like you're either called to it and you have to do it, or you get out as quick as possible, you know?
It's funny, it does have a level of prestige that is not necessarily tied to its economic like recompense, right?
Right.
No, it's interesting. I think especially because we both live in LA and it's an industry town, so novelists are more rare. I
Right,
think it's
and
different
I'm
in New
from San
York.
Francisco, and so, but
Okay.
moving to LA taught me a lot about, and I moved here about 10 years ago because of a film, but moving down here taught me how much of a literary town Los Angeles is, and I thought San Francisco was a literary town, and then you come down here and it's just like, no, this feels like literary towns. It's just like, there is a vibrance for literature in Los Angeles that I don't
Oh,
think
yeah.
people understand outside of Los Angeles, including me, until I came down here.
I think it might be the biggest book market in the country, bigger than New York. I don't quote me on that. But
Oh,
if it's not number one,
we're
if
gonna
it's
have
not number one, it's number
New
two.
York and Los Angeles
Yeah,
fisticuffs. Wait,
I
what? There's gonna
mean,
be a there's gonna be an article in the New Yorker, there's gonna be an article in the Los Angeles Times, and all of a sudden they're
oh,
all
you
gonna
know
be
what? I would love it if enough people heard me talking about this and then bought my book. Great. Let's have an LA New York rivalry. Let's stir
Let's
it
create some
up.
controversy about your book. If you just say something racist that you can get canceled for,
Oh,
and then
man.
apologize, and then all of a sudden the
Oh,
numbers come.
that's a tough road to
Yeah. It's interesting how I'm just thinking about that, because that's a very tough road to go, and I think it's a tough road to go mostly because we just want to be liked as like
Oh,
humans.
yeah. Yeah,
We
it's true. You don't
and
want people mad at you.
yeah, we well, I don't mind if the right people are mad at me. Like the
Right.
people that are just like, oh, you offended me, I'm so mad at you, and I'm just like, cool. It's just all I gotta say is thank you, because you're the person I'd like to be like I'd like to be.
See, I have too much people pleasing. I want even my enemies to like
Oh, really? No, I want my enemies to be so distraught at the huge success that I am, even though I don't feel like
Oh,
a even
nice.
though I don't feel like a success, but don't tell them, but
I
at the
won't tell
huge
them.
success.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Yeah. All right. Well, let's find another strategy for me to go viral.
Yeah, sometimes going viral is like not a great thing, especially when it's sexually
Yeah.
transmitted.
I don't
I love it when the police
know
helicopters, you probably can't hear it on your end, but the police helicopters are coming through my monitor, so someone's doing something out there.
Yeah.
And that's the other
Always
thing
true.
I've learned about living in Los Angeles. You just ignore police helicopters. You just go, oh, pretty
Oh, it's
police
all the
helicopter. And then you see a,
time.
drive-by shooting, and you're like, oh, they're going after that. Well,
Oh.
there's,
Yeah, we have them all day. We also have the military ones because we're near the 101, and I learned this semi-recently. The airspace over a highway is like a highway for planes or a highway for helicopters. So the
oh.
military helicopters fly over the 101, it's their flight path.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't know that either. That makes sense though. And then also they
Yeah,
can
sure.
check in with control towers and let them know where they
Yeah.
are to get that
Also, I could
speed
have
up.
made that up.
No,
Everything I
no, no.
say
And
should be fact-checked.
even if you did make it up, pretend like you didn't make it
Sounds
up,
true.
and it all started
Yeah.
here. We'll bounce around all over the place, but you were in TV for a while, yeah?
I still am, yeah.
Yeah. And so and the
Yeah.
and what are you working on now?
I have a pilot with Hallmark right now. It's a medical romantic comedy TV show, a 1 hour TV show. So it's in the development stage. I'm doing rewrites right now. We'll see what happens. Fingers
Yeah.
crossed.
Cool. And then smash cut back to Costa Rica as a student. When you're when well, first off, why Costa Rica? Why where was there like were there options and you're like, "You know what? No, I'm doing Costa Rica."
I wanted to go to a Spanish speaking country because I wanted my Spanish to get better. I had been interested in Central America for a long time. I studied sociology. I was really political. And, the United States has intervened a lot in Central America in military ways and with their governments. So I was really interested in that. And I went to UC Berkeley. And so the choice in Central America was Costa Rica. So just, I knew that's where I wanted to go. It's beautiful. I love it. It's a very welcoming country to go to as a foreigner. This was, over 20 years ago now, more than that. And there's a fair amount of English spoken in the country, but not a lot. It's not like everybody spoke English, only maybe people working in the hospitality sector, not even then. And so when you were there speaking your slow Spanish, they were really helpful, right? They were really encouraging, like, you're doing great. Which my grandmother, one of my grandmothers was Belgian. And you know how the French are about language. So I was learning French after I spoke Spanish, and I would, practice with my grandmother, and she'd be like, quoi? Quoi? Je ne comprends. And I'd be like, yes, you do. You understand me. You know what I'm saying. Because that's how French speaking people are. But in Costa Rica, they were very encouraging. So the thing that was, I think, transformative, one is learning another language. When you learn another language, you realize that you can have thoughts that you didn't have in your home language. There are words and concepts that don't translate directly. And so you begin to see the world differently because you're looking at it through the frame of a different language. When you're using a different language, you're using a different culture, right? So you're seeing the world through the eyes of a different culture. And then you literally have to learn a different culture. And like little things like gift giving, like you don't show up at someone's house with empty hands, even if you go there all the time, you're still showing up with something. And you're showing up with something for the whole family, not just the hostess, right? And then, Costa Rica is what's considered a middle income country, but it's adjacent to low income countries. And I did travel while I was there to Nicaragua and Cuba. And I think it's important for someone who grew up in a high income country to see what life is like in middle and low income countries. And that changed my worldview a lot.
The do you remember or have this any examples of words or phrases that shifted how you thought of certain things? I know that's a very like, oh, let's just throw this softball
I wish
at
I'd prepared, but it's
you.
not a softball
Look,
since I
I
didn't
didn't
think about
prepare
it.
either. This is what comes out.
Yeah. Well, here's one. There's three different ways to say I love you in Spanish. In
Oh, okay.
English, it's the same. You say I love hamburgers the same way you say I love my spouse or I love my child or I love literature. It's
Right.
the same
And I
phrase.
love all of those equally. I love
Because
you
you
like I
speak
love a
English.
hamburger.
Maybe if you spoke Spanish, you'd feel differently. There is an I love for things. There's an I love for friends and family. And then there's an I love that's more like for your soulmate kind of
Cool.
I
So
love.
what's the I love for things?
Me encanta or me encantan,
Me
depending if
encanta.
it's plural. Me
Okay.
encanta. Or if
Okay.
you want to say I
I
love
won't try
hamburgers,
again.
me
This will turn into a
encantan
lesson of how to move my mouth, Tony.
hamburguesas.
Okay, so that's for things. And then the other one is family?
Yeah, or friends, just
Or
someone
friends?
close to you, but not
Okay.
romantic. You can use it romantically too, but it's just the standard. I love you, te quiero.
Te quiero.
But then there's a stronger one, which is te amo. Okay, and
Te
te amo.
amo. That's the one I know. And I should stop saying that when I'm talking to the cafeteria or the
Probably.
barista. Te amo. Te amo tu café
Oh yeah,
espectaculare.
it's a little intense.
They're just like, wow.
Yeah,
What? Yeah, they're
they
just
probably
like,
have the police on speed dial when you come in.
it's and then the other thing about like the French, like it's what I've been learning as I read. I've This is a really bad idea, but I've been reading Proust in Search of Lost Time, and I'm starting volume
Yeah.
six. Like I've been, I've,
Wow.
I, but at the same time, it's like really great. So it's like I don't recommend it for people, but I highly recommend it for people. So essentially,
Admirable.
but especially if you like French, if you're into like French culture and learning about French history, it's amazing for me because there's a lot of things I didn't know. But the thing about the French is you have to be very careful when you bring in the toi instead of
Oh,
the
right,
vous.
instead of the, right, it's the
Yeah,
same in
where I
Spanish.
think in Espanol, you could do a little
Same.
more, a little more like informal across the board or no? No,
Yeah,
it's the
well, it depends
same.
on the country.
Oh,
If
really?
they have the
Okay.
same, and Costa Rica actually is a third one. So in most Spanish-speaking countries, there's tú and usted. Tú is informal, usted is formal. But
Yeah.
Costa Rica has an older form that came from Spain. I don't know if they use it in Spain anymore. Probably not a lot. It's vos. Okay. In Argentina, they have vosotros,
Right.
which is something else altogether.
Okay.
They use vos in some parts of El Salvador, but not everywhere. So vos is like a more romantic, familiar you, I would say. I would
Yeah.
say. I'm not an expert. So in some countries, the informal too is used, with some frequency. But for example, Costa Rica is a little bit conservative in some ways. And so
Yeah.
use usted. It's considered more polite. Use usted
Okay.
with almost everyone.
Yeah.
In fact, I lived with a host family, and my host parents referred to each other as usted. Most married people, or a lot of married people, we use tú between each other or vos, but they used usted to
Wow.
signify respect to each
And
other.
did they have like, and then when you went to their bedroom, did they have two single beds next to each other and they never
No,
slept
they
together?
didn't. No,
They were
not
like
that
Lucy and
conservative.
Ricardo or Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler
No.
Moore.
Yeah. But so, yeah, I think it varies a lot country to country on that.
And then where as we get into more of your novel, the coffee industry, the what intrigued you with the coffee industry?
When I was a student there, we went on some tours of coffee farms. It's just kind of a common thing people do when they go to Costa Rica. So it's organized through my university. It's,
And where and
I,
where what where were you in Costa Rica? What city were you
San
in?
Jose,
Say, oh, you were in
the
San Jose,
capital.
so you were in the capital.
Yeah. I mean,
Okay.
we traveled a lot on the weekends, but that's where we
Yeah,
were based.
okay.
I think it's, if not their biggest export, it's one of their biggest exports. So coffee is just a big part of the country. And then after I graduated, I worked at a nonprofit in the Bay Area, and I worked on an anti-sweatshop campaign. But I also, the organization also had a fair trade coffee campaign, which I helped with because anti-sweatshop and fair trade are, very aligned projects. And so I worked a little bit on that campaign. I was a union organizer for a while and a community organizer for a while. So fair treatment of workers was something I had always been passionate about. And the inspiration to write this novel was a little bit strange. My kind of stepdad, Peter McKeon, he was a music producer, a music engineer. And we were sitting there having coffee, and he said, "Your experiences in Costa Rica are so fascinating, you should write a book about them." And I think I was 22. And even though my dad is a writer, I didn't ever think that I was going to be a writer. I was a revolutionary. That was my job. And
Wait, did you
I
have the
was like,
Che Guevara shirt for a while too?
I did. I did.
I
I did not know about how violent he was at the time, which
didn't
was.
know how bad it got.
Well, that was an eye-opening part of my political evolution, which I gave to this character, right? Which is that we idolize these people and we believe a narrative that's put forth for us. And then we go into the history and learn it's really complicated, and Che is complicated.
Oh, but I got to tell you, with the Che Guevara biography by John Anderson, I read that in when did I read that? What I'm trying to I read that when I lived in Oakland. That must have been around 1980, I mean 1998, 1999. And that changed my life because I'd grown up a Jehovah's Witness, and that was the first thing that made me go, you better question things. And I was fascinated by Che's early, when in his early life, like the days of the Motorcycle Diaries, and how he was, I mean, he was, and how, like, you know what, the US was fine with slavery in the 1950s as long as it was in another country, you know, the sugar plantations, the slave labor, they're fine with it if it's over there, which might probably has a lot to do with the fair trade, or is it kind of close?
It's abusive. It's abusive labor. Well, not fair trade. When you don't have fair trade, labor is abused. So I sort of on a whim decided to write a book about Costa Rica. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't think of myself as a writer.
Oh my God, that's it. Yes. None of us know what we're doing when we write a novel.
No, I still don't know what I'm doing
Oh my
after
God,
16
thank
years
you
as a
for
TV
saying
writer.
that. Are you, thank you. Now I'm going to make all my students listen to this podcast because they don't believe me. They're like, I'm like, look, you could have 20 books out and you still will feel like an imposter when you start on tw book 21. It's just like, they just look at me like, no, you don't. And I'm like, yes, you do. I've
Yes,
talked
you
to
do.
like hundreds of authors, many bestsellers, and they'll tell you straight up, I feel like an imposter. I don't feel like I belong. And I don't even know what I'm doing, but I just do it again. So,
Whenever I sell something or someone hires me to work on a show, I'm always like, me? Actually, this is my first published thing, wasn't my book, it was a short story. I have the book here. My friend Todd Goldberg is a crime and noir writer, okay?
yeah,
And he was
Todd, I
doing,
love
you know,
Todd.
Todd? Oh, yeah, because you know Mark, so you probably know the crew. Okay. So Todd was doing an anthology of Hanukkah noir, Eight Very Bad
Oh,
Nights.
were you at the Skylight event that they did
Yes!
the? I was not.
Yes! I thought you looked familiar. You are,
Oh, okay.
besides seeing you on the podcast, you are familiar. Okay, yes. All right. So Todd called me, this was in December or January, probably 2 years ago now, and he's like, hey, do you want to submit a story for this collection? And I was out on submission with my novel, but I had not sold it yet. And I was like, me? He's like, yeah, you. And you know, Todd knows everybody, right? So I was like, Todd, did everybody else say no? Like, why are you asking me? Like, I've never been published and I mostly write comedy, you know, and this is noir. I've never written a short story and I've never written noir. He's like, no, you have a messed up sense of humor. Like, you're right for this. Like, okay. And oh, what was I talking about? Oh, I have so much brain damage from all my COVID infections. Oh, how I never think anyone is going to want me to do anything. Okay, so I didn't actually say yes right away. I was like, give me a couple of days to think about it because I didn't want to say yes, write a shitty, a bad story, and let my friend down. You know, I respect him. So I was only going to say yes if I knew I could do a good job. So I thought about it. I realized I had an idea that I could do a good job on. And then it was really successful. And it's now the same short story is in Best American Mystery and Suspense this year. And
Oh,
this story I
fantastic.
almost said no to because I didn't think I could do it. That's how strong my imposter syndrome is,
No,
you know?
you don't believe how much I understand that beyond belief. So what I do is I just say yes immediately with I just dive into the jump in and jump dive into the deep end, and I'm like, oh, of course, yes, I'll do that. And then I'm like, why did I say yes? That was the worst thing I should have ever done in my life. And then from that, something gets created. That's kind of the it, to just say yes. So I do it a little differently because I know if I, you know, if I vacillate back and forth on it, the answer is no. So it's just like it, so I know it goes to no really quickly, and it's probably my Norwegian background through my mom, where they're just like, hey, would you like to be an artist? No. Hey, grandpa, I'm going to be a writer. No. You work on ships. There's just like zero deviating from the narrative of what they think you should be. Anyway, but that's the I should probably do a study on Norwegians, and I should probably go live in Norway and try to understand the Norwegians, and maybe I'll understand myself a little more, because it's
That sounds like
probably.
a very long trip. Like you could do Eat, Pray, Love in Norway.
Yes.
Norway. Maybe
Right.
you can pre-sell it like she did.
Or drink, weep, sleep.
Feel like the third one may need to be more active.
Oh wait, yeah, drink, weep.
Sin.
Well, sin.
There you go.
Sin. Ooh, that's a good, okay, I'm
I
writing
mean,
that
I'd read that
down. It
book.
all started here. It all started here. How did you get
Build
into
a ship.
TV?
That was my Aunt Geraldine. So I'd written this book, 22 when I started. I got an agent and I went out in submission and it didn't sell. And
Oh,
by the time I
is
was
this a novel
25,
or is.
the same book. Okay. Well, not quite, but
Okay.
it was this book. And so I was teaching ESL, I was waitressing, I was still organizing, and I was writing the screenplay. I was just like all over the place doing everything. And I was totally out of
As you
money
should in your
because
20s, you're
waitressing,
supposed to do that.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And organizing, community organizing, teaching ESL, and waitressing doesn't pay very well. So I was
Were
extremely
you
broke.
waitressing up in the Bay Area?
No, here at Jinky's, which is a breakfast spot and an Italian place that's now gone. I was not a great waitress. I was not super at that job. I spilled a lot of items
Oh,
on
yeah.
people. Yeah, I'm a little klutzy.
Yeah.
So my Aunt Geraldine, who's a casting director, said, "Have you ever thought about TV?" And I said, "No, I don't own a TV."
Oh, yeah.
Because I was the total snob, but it was true. I didn't have a TV. She's like, "What do you do? Like when you're not working?" I'm like, "I listen to NPR and read books." Right? And she's like, "Well, maybe like you're broke. Maybe you should think about TV." I'm like,
Yeah.
"Yeah, you're right." And she said, "Have coffee with this guy." And this guy was a script coordinator, and you probably know, but in case your audience doesn't know, script coordinators are assistants on TV shows that format the script correctly and interface between the writing department and the production department. So I had coffee with him and he said, "Hey, if you want to come shadow us for a week, you can do that," which I didn't even realize what an amazing opportunity that is, that that's not normal. I've never seen anyone shadow for a week. I'm the only person I've ever known that's done that, who's been let into a writer's room,
Yeah.
let alone for an hour, like for a week.
Yeah.
And so Steve Levitan was the showrunner. It was a show called Stacked, which was a multi-cam with Pamela Anderson and Bookstore. And the writers were hilarious. They were so funny. I was like, "Oh, I want to do this. Like, this is way more fun than organizing. Like, way more fun than walking on the street all day, knocking on doors and saying, 'Will you strike?'" Right?
Yeah.
So a couple of months later, that guy called me and he said, "Hey, the writer's assistant has left." And that's another assistant position. He's like, "Do you want to come interview?" I was like, "Yeah." And I had a leg up because they knew me because I'd been there for a week. So that's how I got my first assistant position in Hollywood. And it took a couple of years of that before then I became a TV writer.
Cool. And then what was your first TV writing gig?
It was a show based on the movie called 10 Things I Hate About You. It was
Okay.
on what was then ABC Family, which is now Freeform. It was really cute. It was really fun. It was like a high
Yeah.
school comedy.
Yeah, it's I vaguely remember the title of the, was it a book
The
too or
movie.
no?
No, it's an
No.
it was I don't think so. It was a movie that was, I think, a retelling of a modern retelling of The Taming of the Shrew, I think. And that was the best experience. The showrunner Carter Covington is still my good friend and often collaborator on TV projects. The writer's room really bonded. We're all still friends. We still see each other. We still go out for drinks. And
Yeah.
that was, 2009, a long time ago, and we're all still friends. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah, and it's such a different industry now. It doesn't even look like the same industry.
It's so different because then I was a staff writer, which is the first position of writer, and Carter had me overseeing my own episodes on set, which teaches you how to be a producer. That is called the pipeline from staff writer to showrunner. And it's abnormal that you get to do that as a staff writer, but Carter felt like it was really important to mentor people, give people experience. And I even got experience editing, which you very rarely get as a staff writer. And now with Zoom, broke that model. And now newer writers are not getting experience on set, and they're not learning how to produce episodes, which means they're not learning how to become showrunners. It's really bad. It's really, and even though Zoom has gone away to a large extent, the studios don't want to pay for the whole staff to stay on during production anymore. They only like usually pay for like the top two or three people to stay on. And so the newer and mid-level writers are not getting the experience they need. It's a real
Oh,
problem.
so they're just coming in contract freelance for like a couple episodes?
We all come in contract, essentially, freelance, essentially, but they're just coming in for the writing portion. It used to be that you were a writer producer, that we're all writer producers. You know, whatever your title said, you were still producing TV in some capacity if you're on staff. And now that's not true. You may just be writing, and you may be shut out of producing, which
Interesting,
is.
because from what I gathered, if you were getting the writing credit on the show, they would expect the writer to be on set for that one episode.
That depends a lot on the kind of show it is.
Okay.
So, in a multi-cam comedy, all of the writers are there when it's shot because it's
Oh,
shot
right.
live.
Yeah, because you're
Right.
shooting in front of a live audience usually
Right.
too.
And you're all
Okay.
writing jokes in real
Yeah.
time.
Yeah.
In a single camera comedy, you are definitely going to have some writers on set. They might be the executive producers, they might be the writer of the episode, but you're always going to have at least one writer on set because when you have stuff on set, things change. Like the director may need a new line because the actor has to walk further than you anticipated when
Yeah.
you were writing it, right? So you
Yeah.
need to write a line. In comedy, you really need a writer to write that line, right? And
Yeah.
to adjust things. And also, you want the writers there to make sure that the tone comes through. In 1 hour dramas, this varies show to show. Some 1 hour dramas like to have the writers on set, and some 1 hour dramas do not have writers on set. So this is like that's up to the preference of the showrunner.
Yeah, I won't say what the show was, but I got to shadow a friend who was working on a certain show, and it turned out that the writing staff was banned from set after season one, like banned, because one of the writers interrupted the main star during a take and said, "Oh no, excuse me, there's a comma there," and I'm just sitting there going, "Oh, that's." Yeah, that's a bannable offense. You don't interrupt a take when you're a writer.
They interrupted the take.
They were interrupting a take in the middle of the take. They interrupted the take because the star didn't pause on the comma. And that was like,
That's
and don't ever
strange.
come on set again, and your whole staff.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? I mean, the boldness that some people have, boldness. There's other words for it, but we can't use them on radio, so.
I mean, I think it's great to have writers on set. I think but I come from comedy. It's an important part of the process, but not everyone agrees.
I was on set for the film that I wrote through production, and I was brought in on post-production, and I didn't realize how much getting that much access was a privilege. At the
Unusual,
same
yeah, on
time,
a feature.
at the same time, the director was like, "Oh no, I need you on set like every day, and don't go away." While the
That's
producers and
great.
everyone else is trying to keep me off set, he's like, "Just stay by my side."
I'm glad you got to be on set. I think it's important. The
Oh,
writer's the one who created the world.
it's so important to be on set. Plus, I knew the rules though. I knew that. I mean, I did give notes, but when something happened, I'd be like, I would whisper. I would just do a quick whisper. If it was an emergency, I'd whisper into the director's ear. And then he'd be like, "Hey, everyone, just take 5 minutes." And then we'd walk to the side. And then he'd be like, "Hey, you know what? We're gonna do this new thing." And it's just like, it's a director's medium. Let the director take the lead. Just here's the opinion, and take it or leave it, you know?
The vibe is different in TV. The showrunner is in charge, but you still, I think it's DGA rules, you still have to give your note to the director, not to the cast.
Yeah. Oh,
But yeah,
and
film
it's
and TV are different that way.
okay.
Who's
Yeah,
really in
yeah.
charge?
And
But I think that
yeah, at the
probably also
same
depends on some shows.
yeah, because at the same time, the director is kind of the odd person out in a TV show because
Well,
everyone
in
else is
episodic
staffed.
TV, yeah, that's
Yeah.
right. The directors come. It's different if you have a director that's on for the series. Some shows have a director that directs like half the episodes of the
Yeah.
show. They're going to know the show. But if you have a show where you're bringing in a director for one episode, they're not going to know the cast. They're not going to know the roles the way the showrunner does. That's why the showrunner is the one. They're called the showrunner. They're not just the head
Yeah.
writer. They are the person in charge of the show.
Yeah.
But
They're the
some
ones answering to
showrunners.
the upstairs.
Yeah, that's right. Some showrunners figure out a way to not be on set that's effective for them. So John Wells, who's an incredible showrunner and director and writer, he doesn't go on set when he's not directing. But what he does is everyone has what's called a tone meeting ahead of production. So the showrunner is going to meet with the director and department heads to say how they want the tone to be. Well, the department heads aren't necessarily in a tone meeting, but you're going through the script line by line and going, okay, here's the line. But here's the intention. Here's the emotion I want to evoke, right? So you could have a 1 hour tone meeting that's kind of superficial, or you could have like a very intense tone meeting. And I think I haven't watched him do it, but I did go through the showrunner training program and he talked to us. He's very, very detailed tone meetings. So the director already knows what he wants. He doesn't need to be there looking over their shoulder. He's already explained to them in detail what he hopes to get out of the show.
And you've been a showrunner yourself.
Yeah, a show ran what's called a mini room or a pre-greenlight room, which is this unfortunate new thing where a studio will order scripts before they've picked it up to series. So we shot a pilot and we did 5 episodes of a room. Yeah, it was a
Oh,
great
and does that
experience. Too
mean
bad
that
it didn't go.
it doesn't get
It
released?
didn't go to air. Yeah,
Yeah.
no. It's too bad. It was right before the strike. We were supposed to be greenlit the week before the strike. So
Oh.
it kind of did us in. I mean, it
And
did everybody in.
yeah, and that like the strike in the was it in the 1990s? That's like kind of where reality TV took off because that's way the
Yeah,
way
it
they
was.
would bypass when the with the writer's strike. And then all of a sudden, now we got a bunch of stupid shows.
Yeah.
It's
I
like,
do love stupid shows, though, but yeah.
well, I think the demographic is more veered toward the ladies when it comes to the ironic housewives of South
I love them.
Pasadena or
Yeah.
where, whatever.
I don't have time to watch them anymore, but I love them. But yeah.
Yeah, I watch baseball, it's just like that's skewering toward a fella,
Oh, yeah. Is the game at 3 today? I have my kids' baseball practice. It's going to be an issue. We're all going to be watching the game on our
Oh,
phones.
funny. See, I'm from San Francisco, so I live in enemy
Oh, so you're
territory here
not.
in Los Angeles.
Oh,
So I just walk
right.
around. I see Dodger blue. I have to avert my eyes. Even if someone's just
Worked.
wearing Dodger blue and they don't, it's not even about the Dodgers. They just have a shirt that's blue. I have to go,
Oh no. Like cross yourself,
yeah,
spray yourself
exactly.
with
Holy
garlic.
water, garlic, sage. I carry sage with me. It just.
As we all do. Yeah.
I get a kick though. I get a huge kick out of the idea of all these rivalries and sports teams and how important it is. I kind of for all of
It's
us in a
fun.
yeah.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah, it
like
gives us something to enjoy. It's a
yeah.
safe rivalry. Well, until people shoot
Yes.
each other in the parking lot. But until
Yeah.
that point,
Right, exactly. A few people get got in the parking lot. Whatever.
that's the small price to pay for us to have fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
What were you thinking going to a ball game?
Oh, is this how I'm going to get canceled, Tony?
Yeah, we're trying. See, we're trying to get you viral. We're not trying to get you canceled. We're trying to get you viral. So,
Where's the line? No.
I'd say I'm always looking
Go
for the line.
right up to it.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the line. I'm a fan of going over the line and then going, oh crap, that was a bad idea, and then coming back a little bit and
Oh.
hoping that I got the heart. Well, from the writer's room. I mean, you have to go over the line a lot in order to get what you need.
Yeah, that's why they had that landmark case protecting what's said in the writer's room is free speech, basically.
Yeah. Is that the Friends one?
Yeah.
Yeah, 'cause it's
But the vibe has changed in the room. It's not the same anymore. Like,
No, it's
there's
not fun
definitely
anymore
people
from
being
what I
more hurtful.
understand.
Well, I think it's still fun. I think that before my perspective when I started in 2009 is that in some rooms, rooms were almost entirely white, or the rooms I worked in were almost entirely white, and they're almost entirely male. And so people said a
My
lot of
people.
things that
That sounds great.
people,
I want to
yeah,
go. That
they
sounds like
said
a
some
fun
really messed
club.
up. It was not if you're a woman or a minority, not a fun
Well,
club. Maybe fun for you. So people said things that were totally inappropriate because there were very few of us let into those rooms that did not belong to that club, and we didn't have the power to say anything. You'd just get fired. You couldn't do anything about it. So
Oh,
I was
that's not
sexually
cool.
harassed a
Yeah,
ton.
there should be opening for pushback on everything if there's opening for saying anything you want.
Oh, right,
Yeah.
exactly. Like I was fully harassed for years. And
Yeah.
really until Me Too. It didn't change until Me
Yeah.
Too. So, yeah. Less fun for some, more fun for others. Bit of a
Well,
trade-off.
yeah. I mean, as far as the industry is concerned, I don't give it that much thought for absolute creativity. I give more thought for absolute creativity when it comes to the novel, the medium of the novel, because that's where we can go, hey, this is where I'm going. And then when you get to that final draft and you get it published, and it's like, here's where I went, deal with it. And
I'm surprised that there's thought policing in literature because
oh,
characters should be allowed
it
to be
disgusts me
bad.
on all sides.
If a character says something bad, that is because they are bad. Can't we have bad
Yeah,
characters? I think
yeah,
we should be allowed to have bad characters.
yeah. No,
I remember when
it's.
Elizabeth Gilbert pulled one of her books because it was about people in Russia in the 1800s, and she had to pull it because Ukrainians were upset about the book being about Russians. And I don't know, I didn't understand that. I'm super pro Ukraine, by the way. But I was like, well, why does this book need to be pulled? Because there's some good Russian characters.
That's yeah,
That's scary to me.
it's no, it's kind of scary to me at the same time. That's where indie publishers thrive. That's where Grove Press publishes Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller finally. And these things create something more. So I think there's always a action reaction, action reaction. And I just don't want to, I don't want to be anywhere on the side of I do have to pull back. I mean, I have a novel that's with a couple of different agents right now. I've been querying, and so it's sitting
Good
on
luck.
desks, but it took me 4 years to write it because I did have to go over the line over and over again because it's a comedy, but
Yeah,
going
so
too
hard in
far over
comedy.
the line was a problem because it was losing the heart. And so
Yeah.
I had to go back and forth on that. And there were some really crass drafts, but in order to get to the draft that I needed, I had to go really crass and then bring it back.
Yeah.
So, and
It's
that's what I
interesting.
have to do as a writer. But
Yeah.
it's not a, what do you call it? I'm not going to publish the earlier drafts. This is just how I get to these tight 235 pages that somebody can
That
consider and
is tight.
go, yeah.
Yeah, I, yeah.
Do you go back to Costa Rica? Do you try to
I
keep a
went
foot in the
back a
door down
couple
there?
of years after I graduated. I went back a couple of years later, but I haven't been since then. I would like to go. We're thinking about going sometime in the near future, but yeah,
Cool.
it's so great there. But no current.
Yeah. And oh, but let's go back to something that I just remembered that we were talking about 37 minutes ago, which was you submitted this book in your
Oh,
20s and
yeah.
it got
I was
rejected.
25. It got rejected.
So that
I
so
started
just
working
to
on
let
TV.
just to bring the listeners in, if they just came in, we're talking about Love, Coffee, and Revolution, a novel with Stephanie Leder, and this book. What year is this that the book was went out for submission, where you had an agent, right? It went out for
Yeah,
submission
mid
and
two
then it was
thousands, I
turned
guess.
down. What, how long ago was that?
Mid 2000s somewhere,
Yeah,
or
okay.
later.
And here we are, mid
Yeah.
2020s, and it
Yeah,
just
20 years
came
later.
out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I put it away for I don't know, 15, 15 years. I've lost track now. And I became a TV writer. But in the back of my head, I always felt like I could publish it. And the reason I felt that is because my friend Todd Goldberg, who you know, had read it because I had taken a workshop class with him when I was like 23 or something. And he always felt like this book was good enough to be published. And so during the
Was
pandemic,
that when he was at Extension?
he was at UCLA.
Yeah, I teach there too.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I taught their ESL, so a different part of UCLA Extension.
Oh, cool.
During the pandemic, I was going out with a pilot. My producer went AWOL because it was so chaotic in the very beginning of the pandemic when
Yeah.
everything went into Zoom. I was like, you know what? I'm going to pull out my book. I'm going to rewrite it. Like, I have 15 or whatever years of experience as a TV writer now. I'm a much better writer than a 22-year-old who had natural talent, but not a lot of craft skill, right?
Yeah.
So I rewrote it. I just said to myself, if this were a movie, what would the acts be? And, you know, I basically just tightened it. It didn't require big structural changes, it required tightening. Some work on the sentence level. I strengthened part of the love triangle, you know, and then that was kind of it. And then I was, you know, Todd runs the Riverside, the residency MFA program.
Yeah.
I go there and guest teach like every year and a half or so. I was there, I don't remember, maybe 2022, I'm not sure. And I met an agent there just casually at a party. You know, and he's like, how do you know Todd? So I had to tell him. He's like, oh, so you've written a book. I'm like, yes. He's like, what
I love how
happened to
you then now for those of you listening,
it?
Stephanie brought her head down and she said yes. Which is
Because it's
how every real writer should react to that.
was
Because the
so
ones that go,
embarrassed.
yes, are the ones that you should not even talk to for another second.
So he's like, well, what are you doing with it? I'm like, you know, I forgot. I'd started querying at the end of 2020 or 21, and no one was reading. I wasn't getting
Yeah.
any responses at all. Like, not even no thank you. You know, I did get a couple of responses, but mostly it just ghosted. And so Judd asked to read it and Judd liked it. And so then we went out of the submission. But yeah, it was crazy. It was 20 years later.
Yeah. And that's fantastic that you kept the fire burning. And I think that's the importance of, because I call this stuff magic, just pure magic. Because it's just you have an idea. Oh, you know, one day you have an idea, and then what does that idea become? Well, if we work hard enough, it becomes a book that's on the bookshelf. And then that idea is like crafted into something that almost should have never been, with all the hard work we have to do.
So
One,
much
to
work.
write it, two, to get it on a shelf.
No, it's true. It's crazy. I sold this Hallmark pilot that I sold, I guess, last year. I had written that like 6 or 7 years before. Usually, when you write a pilot and no one buys it, it's dead. But my manager remembered it. And when Hallmark was looking for a rom-com 1 hour, he's like, do I have the rom-com 1 hour for you? I mean, that's crazy. But, you know, Mad Men was like that. I think Matt Weiner had written it many years before he actually ended up selling it and making it. So, just because you don't sell something right away doesn't mean that you won't. You know, like what people want, what the market is looking for changes all the time. When I wrote
Yes.
this book, you know, it's a coming of age book with a political plot, but people could superficially think maybe it was chick lit or a rom-com because it's funny and it's young and it's female. And so back when I submitted it the first time, it didn't fit in the chick lit genre because it was about macroeconomics, trade, existential philosophy. You know, it wasn't about boys and losing weight and dresses. You know, it was, the tone was light, but the subject matter was serious. And there wasn't a market for that or a strong market for that at the time. Now, when I went out this time, there is. There's something called book club fiction or upmarket fiction, which is, as you know, it's like between commercial and literary. It's about something serious or of importance, maybe, but it has a more commercial pacing, right? It's like something is happening. That market wasn't there when I tried to sell it the first time.
It just sounds like that they weren't looking for intelligent books, and 20 years
Or if they were
ago.
looking for intelligent books, they were looking for intelligent books that were very serious, you know, that had a certain,
Oh, right.
that's the thing.
Right.
This book
Yes.
does not feel serious. This book feels like fun. You know, it
Right.
is fun. It's meant to be fun. It's not meant to be homework. I
Right.
think that there were readers for it, but there wasn't a place on the bookshelf for it, right? So
Yeah.
that makes it hard to buy.
Yeah.
It's hard to market a book when you're like, what is the genre? You're like, everything. The genre's
Oh
everything.
wait, I just I've only I remember as I've been querying, and querying kind of got me back to what it's like. Oh, what's an upmarket? Wait, what?
Yeah.
What's a cli-fi? What does that mean? And it's I'm just like, can't you know? To one of the agents who wanted my book had this whole packet I had to do that was also like the promotional stuff and what genre it's in and who would be the reader. And I'm just like, don't you have a there's going to be a marketing department. I only know the writing part. I don't know the other part. But at the same time, I my saying no in my head, I went ahead and did it. And then I learned a little more about myself and the book and went, oh wait, that was why I wrote the book. And that's the message. Even though the book is a comedy, it's a tragedy to me. And
Oh,
so
sounds like it might be upmarket then, or book club
I think it's
fiction.
upmarket. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll
Yeah.
just say that with authority. When
Yeah.
someone goes, do you have a book? I'll be like, yes, it's upmarket. And they'll run.
Right.
Very cool. So you're working on a new book now because now you got the bug.
Yeah, so hard. I forgot how hard the first draft is.
I think we need to forget how hard it is
Yeah,
in
or you
order to
don't want to
get
do
back
it.
in. Yeah.
Yeah, I keep asking myself, why am I doing this?
And I
Why
feel like,
did I become a management consultant, right?
right, but I also feel like going this far into a narrative actually teaches our, it gives us a soul, like a little soul rinsing or something. I'm not
Oh,
quite sure
yeah.
how to say it, but it makes us look within ourselves as authors, and then hopefully our readers look within themselves. So I
Oh,
feel
yeah.
like there is a bit of a calling of I don't want to sound too hippie, but like almost a spiritual calling when it comes to.
Oh, for sure. You know, when I wrote Love, Coffee, and Revolution, I was trying to work out for myself two things. And one was sort of my political evolution from very committed extreme leftist to center left. But it was about someone who really believed things were black and white. And then learned that they weren't, which is the process of maturation, right? Becoming an
Yeah.
adult. And being able to tolerate, listen to, and maybe be friends or lovers with people that don't see the world the way you see the world, right? And
Yeah.
if you listen to them, your opinion might change. That was one thing I was working out. The other thing I was working out was how to live with anxiety. How to live with feeling like you can't do it, like you're not strong enough, like you're not brave enough, which is how that character feels, which I think is how so many young people feel, right? And I found answers to that in my own life that helped me. And I wanted to help other people. I want young people, young women, but young men too, to read this book and have hope that they can also find their confidence and find a way to live with anxiety because initially I thought I had to get rid of it. I thought I had to do therapy or I never took medication, but that's the other way, right? Get rid of it. And then I learned kind of this more Buddhist attitude towards it from Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, which is to be like, hey, anxiety, I see you. Like, just let it be there, right? It doesn't have to control you, it can just be along for the ride. And when it's like what you resist persists, right? So stop resisting it, just let it be. And that helped me so much. So, yeah, I was working those things out. And the book I'm working on now, I'm working out something different for myself, which is faith, right? Really wrestling with why are we here? What is reality? And if you're wrestling it with it, so are other people, right? And
Yeah.
so I think that I'm saying what you were saying, but in
And
more
then,
words.
no, but it's, and I'm sitting here going, Wow, yeah. No, you said it more profoundly, I promise.
Well, thank you.
We'll do a poll. Who said it more profoundly, kids? The book is called Love, Coffee, and Revolution, a novel. Her name is Stephanie Leder. Stephanie, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Tony.
And cut.
Thank you to everyone for listening. Okay,
Oh,
yeah.
wait. Okay, now cut.
Sometimes